So before we get into 1 Timothy chapter 5, I want to thank Rob Horger and Tim Pell for filling in the last couple of weeks while I have been in South Africa, which looks like that. And utterly beautiful place. I'm not going to take a lot of time to talk about South Africa, but I'm going to give you a little bit of an idea of what I see and experience when I'm there. This is my fifth trip to South Africa, and it's almost become a home away from home to me. And what's so nice, though I don't get to see you people when I'm gone, I get to meet people just like you. And they have a sweet spirit. They have a love for God and for one another, a love for His Word, and they're growing. And we've been around a few years longer than these groups are that I go and speak to. But they're always asking questions about you. They know your voices, and they don't have faces to go with so many of the voices that ask questions and share things during the teachings. But they send their love. And I couldn't begin to tell you how many times people said, send our love to your family and the people at Beth Dikkun. And so anyways, a few misconceptions about South Africa. When you mention the name Africa, you all conjure up jungle movies and Tarzan and huts and natives running around, you know, and wild animals and all of that. But we're not talking about West Virginia here. We're talking about South Africa, which is a very developed and a very modern country and a very old one. And it's not just the south part of Africa, it's the Republic of South Africa. That is its name. And its history goes back a lot longer than ours does. Cape Town, which is where I flew into, was founded in the 1650s. And the Dutch and the English have had a presence there that entire time, which is why you hear some people speaking in English and others speaking in Afrikaans, which is a dialect, a Dutch dialect. But most people speak both. But the country is absolutely beautiful. And, well, that's interesting. Where did that come from? Okay. We'll try that again. Wow, I didn't know it would do that. We'll just skip that one then. Okay, we'll just... Oh, it's playing up there. I see. Why didn't somebody say something? Okay. But you have these ancient, not ancient, but these old vineyards. There are hundreds of vineyards all around this area and orchards and so on. And this is a wine farm, they call it, orchard, that's over 300 years old. And this building was built in the 1670, I believe. But it's just a gorgeous area, and a lot of thatched-roofed houses as well, which surprised me. And this is the entrance to one of the vineyards. You go to a vineyard to eat dinner and to have a glass of wine, just see the beautiful area. But if you can see, this was founded in 1692. That's how old this particular vineyard is. And some of the buildings there, the homes and lodges, you can see are just amazing. So this is one side of Africa, and the manicured gardens, and the mountains and ocean. Everywhere you look one way, there's mountains, look other way, there's the ocean, and sometimes you can see both at the same time. So it's quite a beautiful place, and it's quite the tourist spot as well. And it's kind of fun watching these guys try to catch a breeze as they sail off on their whatever they call those inflatable wings. But this is very near Cape Town here. But on the other hand, you see this, where you have squatters, thousands and thousands of people, and there are no laws whatsoever about where they build, how they build, but they get a free electricity, and they all have satellite dishes on their little shacks. And basically, they are a law unto themselves. And so you'll be passing along areas where the government basically has no say, but people just set up their little shanties, and they'll be there for miles and miles and acres and acres and acres of them. And most of these people work. They will be working different jobs and so on, but it's also an issue how to bring these people up, to get them educated, and to really incorporate them into modern life there. So it is a growing problem. So South Africa is a place of stark contrast. This is just along the southern coast there, too. And the weather was in the 80s every day. It dipped into the 70s a couple days, up in the low 90s other days. But just beautiful, beautiful weather. And that guy is my buddy Percy. And he and his wife, Christelle, are the ones who were instrumental in bringing me over this time to their congregation, which I had not visited before. And so pray for them. Their congregation, he is one of the main leaders. Their congregation is made up of small groups, been meeting on their own, but once a month they get together to make one big group. But they're moving towards possibly just making that a more permanent establishment with the small groups meeting during the week. So Percy and I and the leadership had many opportunities to talk about how to do things and ask questions about how we've done things here. And the first week I stayed with this lovely couple. This is Chris and Betsy DeHart, and they have an amazing home. Chris is an architect. He's a genius. If I've ever met a genius, Chris is one. I hope if he listens to this, he doesn't get a big head, but he really is a genius. He's designed thousands of houses, but also entire towns, villages. He does a lot of work in Israel, and their home, even before he got interested in Israel, it's almost like God gave him a premonition, and he designed his home like an Israeli home, as actually a small Israeli town. It's got its own chapel that he built. There's water everywhere. There are rocks everywhere. There's even water running down the side of the hallway going through the house, waterfalls in the back, channels of water everywhere. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful place. And this is the congregation that Percy helps oversee. And they're seeing Christelle there in the second row. And they're all waving, saying hi to you guys. And then I went down the coast a ways, a couple hundred miles, to George, which is called the Garden Route along the south coast of Africa. And this is Chris and Ruth Kuntz. I stayed with them last time, about a year ago when I was there. And they just live very close to the coast. And the name of their congregation is Restoration Fellowship. What's the Hebrew name for restoration? Tikkun. Think that's a coincidence? And they've been renting this venue here for about 4 or 5 years. Before they rented it, it was an interior design business called Robin's Nest. And just a great group of people. It's a larger, a little more established congregation than the one in Somerset West near Cape Town. But it's wonderful to be back with them again. By the way, the teachings, if you're interested, the teachings I did in both places are on YouTube if you have trouble sleeping at night. And this is the leadership of the Restoration Fellowship. These are the elders and their wives. There on the right are Johan and Hannah Lee. And this is the view I looked out at every day from their place. So not too shabby, huh? So just a beautiful setting. And then just last Wednesday, we drove into the South African Jewish Museum. There's a sizable Jewish presence in Cape Town as well. This is the largest synagogue there. Just a beautiful place and quite large. So it was interesting to get a little bit of the history and the background of the Jewish presence in South Africa. So those are just some of the pictures. That wasn't too painful, was it? Well, it gives you a bit of an idea of what I see when I'm down there and wish I could share with all of you. But that's a little bit on South Africa. We can pause for a question because I know I'm skipping lots of things, but are there any burning questions you want to ask about the trip right now that I could give you a short answer to? If not, we'll get right into the study then. Yes, Deborah. Oh, no, I taught pretty much every night. Yeah, I taught some studies during the day in homes. On Shabbat, I taught, I think, each Shabbat a couple or three times. No, they kept me busy, but they gave me a lot of downtime as well. Yeah. So, I did quite a bit of teaching. I forget how many teachings I've done. But, it was great. But they always spoiled me during the day. But, wonderful hospitality they have there. Anything else? Yes, David.
How can we pray for them? What do you think is their biggest challenge?
That's a great question. Thank you for bringing that up. How do we pray for them? They're young congregations, and when congregations are young, small errors can have long-time big effects on the congregation. So just pray that God gives the leadership clear direction and to be strong and courageous and joyful. And when a congregation is young, wolves are always hovering about. So for God's protection and guidance in that, they'll become well-established. So they have all the issues that a small congregation has here. So, but there, in America, we have so many denominations that when a new one pops up, especially here in the north, nobody thinks twice about it. But to be messianic down there, you're going against the major congregations. So number one is the Dutch Reform. Almost every person I talked to came out of the Dutch Reform Church. I don't even know we have Dutch Reform in Ohio, but there everything's Dutch Reform. And then there are a few others that came out of the Baptist or Methodist or some charismatic group. But that's about it. There's not much else. You have Jews, Jewish in synagogues. You have some Catholics, not too many. But that's it. And so if you're not one of those, it's like you're an alien. So they have a lot going against them in that. On the other hand, the people are so hungry for authenticity. People are so hungry. And they just wake up and decide that they want to go back to Torah. In fact, I mean, it sounds odd for me to say this, but there's some people who flew in nearly 1,000 miles to come because I'm there teaching. Because they have nothing in their area. So they hear somebody's coming from the States to do some teaching. They get on a plane and they fly in. Others drove hundreds of miles to be a part of the teachings. So it really felt like the pressure was on. So these people, I didn't want them to be wasting their time and energies. But there's such a hunger there. There's such a hunger. So, one more, then we'll move on. Okay, are we good? Yes, over here. Ah. Yeah, it's interesting. Where did the people in the shanties come from? Originally, most of them migrated from somewhere north of the country. They came down because there was work. And so you've got, I think, 4 or 5 basic native groups. And what's interesting, it's a very different history than what we have here with racial tensions in our country. Their history is completely different from ours. The dynamics are very, very different. But one of the things I found interesting is you've got, and now again, please take this for what it is. These are the terms I use. You've got the black population, which is the original native blacks, and they also have their own dialects. So they'll speak English or Afrikaans, but also their own dialect for their tribe. And then you've got the whites, and then you've got what they call the colored, which are the mixed, which the blacks do not get along with. So you'll have a black section, but then you have the colored, which are part black, part white, and they don't get along with each other. And then you've got the whites. You've got 3 groups, which I found fascinating. So you'd be driving along, yeah, that side of the road, those are the blacks, and this side's the colored. And those are the terms that are used by everybody there. And again, those terms sound kind of racist to our American ears, but I'm just using the terms they're used in South Africa. But many of them work as domestics in homes. They work in various jobs here and there, and some do turn to a life of crime. So it's a difficult place to live. But people do make their way out. People do find ways to advance, and they become the heroes. They're the ones who move on and can help show the way for others. It's going to take a long time since apartheid, when the damage was done by that, and now like overnight, apartheid is done away with, and now there's another adjustment to go through, and it's going to take a while. It's going to take a while. But I tell you what, if things come together in South Africa, there's nothing to keep them from the financial richness and opportunity and wealth that we have in the U.S. They have incredible natural resources there. And the way things just grow out of the ground. In fact, there are more there in the Cape Town area and along the south coast, there's a wider collection of flora, of plants and flowers and trees, a greater concentration of variety than any other place in the world. And they call that the garden route. They call this like the Garden of Eden, there between the mountains and the ocean along the south coast. Beautiful place. It's paradise. It truly is. So anyways, if they can, they need a good leader who has strong convictions, who's a godly man. And there's one or two on the horizon. And black leaders, if they can get into power, it can have an incredible impact on that country. So that's one way you can pray, that they'll get a godly man in there as a president. They've had some criminals up till now. And so they get a godly leader, it can change everything. Yeah. So anyways, but it's an amazing place. And if you want to go visit some place, I put South Africa way high on the list. So in fact, Cape Town's one of the top 10 tourist attractions in the world. And it contains one of the seven natural wonders of the world, which is Table Mountain, which I didn't show you here. It's an incredible landform. There's nothing like it anywhere else. Okay, with that, we're going to get into 1 Timothy. And I was ambitious. I communicated with David about a week ago because David prints our CDs. And I said, David, I'm going to conquer or try to get through chapters 5 and 6 this week. So I guess you could call this week's teaching 1 Timothy 5 and 6, part 1, which will be chapter 5. And next week we'll do 1 Timothy 5 and 6, part 2. All right? So that's just how it's going to be. All right, 1 Timothy chapter 5. Do not rebuke an elder. Or it could be translated elder man. It's the same word, prosbyteros, that we saw earlier referring to elders. So, do not rebuke an older man, but encourage him as you would a father, younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger women as sisters in all purity. So here is Paul's formula for community respect. So whoever you are, the older men you treat as fathers, older women as moms, younger women as sisters, younger men as brothers. Because as we know, everyone respects their parents and gets along with their siblings. At least we should treat each other as we should treat our parents and our siblings. There should be that kind of respect. And then he has this long section on widows. So in verse 3, we're going to read right on through to 16, and then we'll come back and kind of break this down. Honor widows who are truly widows. But if a widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show godliness to their own household and to make some return to their parents, for this is pleasing in the sight of God. Now skip to verse 9 for a moment because this continues that thought. In verse 9 it says, let a widow be enrolled if she is not less than 60 years of age, having been a wife of one husband, having a reputation for good works. Sorry, that is not the passage. Let's just go back and pick it up again. This is jet lag talking right now. Okay, verse 5. She who is truly a widow, left all alone, has set her hope on God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day. But she who is self-indulgent, not a true widow, who is self-indulgent, is dead even while she lives. Self-indulgent is a pretty mild term for this Greek word. The Greek word is used here. It's used also in James 5:5. It really means to really invest yourself in things you should not, and to wanton things and things that could even be considered quite immoral. Command these things as well, so that they may be without reproach. But if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and that's the verse I was looking for, if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for members of his household, he has denied the faith. We're to take care of our relatives, especially our parents. And we want to just, and I'm not saying, now don't get me wrong, I'm not saying there's not a point where a retirement home, an assisted living home, is not the best option for them. But if that is the option for them, don't take a hands-off attitude. You be involved in their lives. You visit them. You check on them. You make sure they're being taken care of the best they can. Make them feel like you're just visiting them in their own home. Don't abandon your parents. In fact, in most ancient societies, children would look forward to the day where their parents would be dependent upon them so that they could begin to pay back the love and attention and generosity the parents lavished on the children when the children were small. This is the way it's meant to be. All of us were children at some point, and we had to be taken care of. When your parents get old and it's your opportunity to take care of them, you must show the same generosity of time and resources to them as they did to you when you were a child. And even more, because you may have more to give them than they had to give you. This is something where we as a believing community should set apart from the world and set a standard, be a shining light because of how we take care of our elderly, especially our own parents. Because if you don't, you've denied the faith, and you're worse, not as bad, but worse than an unbeliever. That's strong language. That is really strong language. By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, by your love one for another. Well, if our love for one another is supposed to be way up here, what should our love for our elderly parents be? Even higher. And if you're not taking care of those people, then your faith is upside down. Something's terribly wrong with your faith, if you have faith at all. And then it goes on in verse 9, let a widow be enrolled if she is not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one husband. Now, he doesn't explain what enrollment is. Back in Acts, I think it's chapter 6, it talks about the enrollment of the widows. Obviously, in the ancient world, in the first century assembly, and maybe even apart from the assembly, but among non-believers as well, widows were taken care of there in the Greek world. And there were societies and there were ways that the people would take care of the widows and the orphans. But in this case, especially the widows. And so we don't have all the details. There are things written by some of the ancient Greek writers, but I wish there was more from Paul and more from the early fathers about what this looked like. But when a woman lost her husband, then it became very important to make sure she's taken care of. Family must take care of her first. And he goes on to say that if she's young, she should find a husband. But if she's 60 years old or older, and having, verse 10, having a reputation for good works, if she has brought up children or nourished children, has shown hospitality, has washed the feet of the holy ones. In other words, she has served the people who are leading the assembly, has cared for the afflicted, and has devoted herself to every good work, but refused to enroll younger widows. That sounds harsh, but that's what he says. Don't enroll the younger widows. This enrollment took the form of some type of payment that would go out, probably in the form of food as well as money that would go out to the widows every week. I've read in one place it would be done on a Friday. They would put out this payment to the widows and the needy, but especially the widows who were enrolled. They would make sure they got their pay and their food every Friday so they could have a nice Shabbat and have food left over for the week. But it refused to enroll younger widows. For when their passions draw them away from Messiah, they desire to marry and so incur condemnation for having abandoned their former faith. Now, we must read that with first century eyes. It doesn't mean if you're a young woman or a younger, kind of youngish woman, and your husband dies, that if you get married, you've abandoned the faith. That's not what it means at all. What it means is this, is that sometimes a young woman, 20s, 30s, 40s even, she loses her husband, and she's just, torn up. She's in grief. She's sad. Her world has been broken in half. And she, in the emotion of that, she says, I'm just going to give the rest of my life, Lord. I don't ever want another husband. It took me all this time to train that one. I'm not going to start over. I'm just going to give myself to the Lord, serve people full time, just plug in, and that's what I'm going to do. Is devote myself to prayer, to fasting, to serving the community, and just that's what I'm going to do. And she makes that proclamation. But then after a year or two or three, that begins to weaken. And what she's done, she's now not condemned in that. She's become a bad person, but she's made this proclamation. Now she's backing off from it. And God never approves of when we make a proclamation, we make a commitment, that we back off from it. Okay? And that's what it's warning against. We should never take an oath or a vow of something and not fulfill it. And he's just saying in their grief, these young women can make these commitments and these vows that later they wish they hadn't, and then they may break them. And so they've abandoned their former faith. Not faith in God, not faith in Messiah, but their former faithfulness in serving as they committed themselves to serve. Verse 13, besides that, they can learn to be idlers, going about from house to house. And not only idlers, but also gossips and busybodies saying what they should not. So he's just saying there's a danger here. It wasn't like today where a young woman who's single can go pursue a career. Back then, if you were a woman, your career was wife and mother, period. And before you start thinking, well, that's just so harsh. People were such misogynists back then. Let's get something straight. Life was hard for everybody. If you were a man, life was hard. If you were a woman, life was hard, period. Life was hard. Not like today. And so men had to do the things men had to do, and women had to do the things that only women can do. Everybody was expected to pitch in and do what they are meant to do. Women make wonderful wives, not men. They make incredible mothers. Men don't. So wives and mothers and all the work that goes along with that is what women did. And all the other kinds of work and hardships that men can bear, that's what men did. Nobody complained, I wish I was a man or I wish I was a woman. Life was what? Hard. You didn't have time to whine. Be grateful you live in a generation and in a part of the world where you can whine. Back then you couldn't. I'm not saying you should, but the very fact that we whine shows that we're spoiled. That life's gotten easy. We start whining because I don't like the job I have. Or I had to get up in the middle of the night and change diapers. I get tired of packing lunches for my husband. So? If you're whining, your life's too easy. That's all I got to say. If you got time to whine. Wah. All right. Verse 14, so I would have, Paul says, I would have younger widows marry, bear children, manage their households, and give the adversary no occasion for slander. For some have already strayed after Satan. If any believing woman has relatives who are widows, let her care for them. Let the church not be burdened. so that it may care for those who are truly widows. There's that phrase, truly widows. So let's look at this, the proper care of widows. You could call this Paul's field guide to widows. First of all, there's the true widow, and here are the traits of a true widow. First of all, she has no family. She has no family. Her husband's dead. Who knows what's happened to the kids? She is all alone. She sets her hope on God. She devotes herself to God. She continues in prayer. She is 60 years old minimum. She's the wife of one husband. She has a reputation for good work. She's raised her children, shown hospitality, served the community, cared for the sick, and devoted to every good work. He says, this is the woman that you enroll in the role, that you take care of this widow. You put her in the role. She gets some money every week. She gets food every week. You make sure her needs are met, because she's a valuable member of the community with her prayers, with her hospitality, with the wisdom that she's accrued. She's in a position to teach younger women to be the godly women that they should be. He says, these are the women you take care of, no questions asked. But then there's the partial widow. She's a widow, but she has children and family who can help. Then they take care of her. That's how it's done. There's the self-indulgent widow. Now that she doesn't have a husband, she pursues her own pleasures. Maybe he died and left her money. And so she decides, I'm going to go enjoy myself. And that is when danger really sets in. You know, I've seen some women who've lost their husbands to become widows, and they become increasingly godly people. And others, it's like, school's out, I'm going to go party. And it's a sad thing to see. Paul says of them, she is dead while she lives. She's dead while she lives. Instead of investing her life and the year she has remaining in an eternal kingdom where there is reward laid up forever, she lives like she's dead, as if there's nothing else for her to do, as if her life is over and she's just going to have pleasure. And there's nothing she adds to her account with the time she has left. It's a strong temptation, I'm sure, for a woman who is left alone and now has some resources. But we have to decide who our king is, which world we live in, who we serve. And then there's a young widow. And Paul says, she may tend to idleness. Therefore, she should remarry. Okay? And that's what Paul has to say about widows. Now, there's a lot here I don't understand. There's a lot here that I have to try to think, okay, this is first century situation. How do we apply these principles to the 21st century? And these are things that leadership always need to work through. I do know here at Beth Dacoon that we do help with needs that people have, whether a man or a woman, a widow or whatever. But one of the things we do check into is what resources do they have? Are those resources being used wisely? Are there things that can be done to make those resources grow? We want to see what is there already so we can step in when no one else will or can. But we can help that person learn to multiply their resources. And so we provide education as well. It's been an amazing thing to watch the elders work in this way. Well, let's continue on. Notice I did not give you time to ask questions about widows because I have no other answers than the ones you've heard. All right, so verse 17. Let the elders, this again is the same word, the presbyteros, the elders, the elder men, elder women, let the elders who rule well be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in word and teaching. If your translation says preaching and teaching, scratch out preaching. Preaching is a different word. That's the word evangelo, to proclaim the gospel. That is not the word used here. This is the word, logos. So those especially who labor in the logos and in teaching the logos. So it's studying and then teaching. For the scripture says, quote, this quoting Deuteronomy now, 25:4. Apparently, Paul did not get the memo that the Torah has been done away with. And he quotes it here authoritatively, you shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain. And, quote, the laborer deserves his wages, unquote. So the ox treading out the grain, what does this mean? Well, when they would harvest grain, like wheat, it'd be these hard husks, and they would take it and just lay it all over the ground. They'd have an ox or two come in with this sledge, this heavy weight, and drag it across the grain, and it broke it all up. Then they'd take their winnowing forks and start throwing this stuff in the air, and the wind would blow the chaff away, and then you had the grain. So what the ox did, he took the husk, and he's able to break it open so they could get out the important bit. You know, people have often asked me, well, what is your title? Is it rabbi? I said, no. Is it pastor or preacher? No, not so much. Oh, what is it? It's just like I'm an elder. That's the word. I'm too young to be an elder by far. But anyways, I'm just one of the elders. I mean, among the elders, I'm just one of the elders. I'm not up here. I'm just one of the elders. But for paperwork and all of this, we had to have something to call me, so they called me congregational leader, which I still not real crazy about. But I finally, after reading this, I have a title for me. I'm Beth Tikkun, COO, the chief operating ox. That is my job. So the new letterhead will have COO of Beth Tikkun on it. But it's been my joy to take the word and labor in it. And, you know, the ox, as he's doing this, he's eating. And while I'm doing this, I'm feeding on the word, and the elders here have taken such good care of Robin and me, thanks to you. And it's just been a joy treading out the grain for this congregation. So I hope I can continue to keep up the work as long as God wants me to and you'll have me. And then it says in verse 19, do not admit a charge against an elder, except on the evidence of two or three witnesses. Again, quoting Deuteronomy 19:15 here, on the evidence of two or three witnesses. As for those who persist in sin, rebuke them in the presence of all, so that the rest may stand in fear. In the presence of God and of Messiah Yeshua, and of the elect angels, I charge you to keep these rules without prejudging, doing nothing from partiality. That's a powerful verse. In the presence of God, and I like to translate Messiah Yeshua as King Yeshua, and of the elect angels, I charge you to keep these rules without prejudging, doing nothing from partiality. Sometimes I think two verses that we should all memorize and review every single day are these two, Proverbs 18, verses 13 and 17. They say this, he who gives an answer before he hears, it is folly and shame to him. The first to plead his case seems right until another comes and examines him. One of the saddest things I experience is when two people at Beth Tikkun, especially, and it happens rarely, but it's so painful when it does, two people at Beth Tikkun have a falling out. One gets a grudge or an attitude towards another because of something that they heard, because it's something they perceive, and they hear only one side. Such a decision is folly and shame to you if you do that. You know what I do when I hear something against somebody else? First job is I put it away, and I don't make any decision. I don't believe it is what I do. I just put it aside. I don't believe it, but I put it there. It's just like in a holding cell until I could talk to the other person and get the other side And when I do this, I am always eternally grateful that I did. Because one side of the story is always wrong in some regard. Always wrong. And when you hear the other side, it's like, oh, okay? Because you know what the saying is, a half-truth is a whole lie. And when you have half the story, I don't want folly and shame to follow me. I get the other side. Always get the other side. Put the two together. Then you can make a decision. And I tell you what, for we as elders who have to make decisions that affect this community, this is policy. This is our policy. We're not going to jump on anything till things are established. And this has protected us over and over and over again. And one of the reasons I value these two verses so much is because so many times in my life, I didn't do what these two verses say. And I was ashamed. I made a fool of myself. I don't want to do that anymore. I want to get it right from here on out. And I challenge you to get it right. So whatever you may hear, put it aside, put it in a holding cell. Just wrap it back up in its package and put it aside till you get the other side of the story. And talk to the person. Call the other person. Say, I need to find out something from you. Can you tell me what happened here in this situation? Find some tactful way of getting the rest of the information. And if it turns out the one side was true, which it never will be, but if it turns out it is, okay. Now you can start to put some faith in it and decide the course forward. But don't make a verdict. Don't make a verdict at all. Get both sides of the story. Okay? So whatever Robin tells you about me, come talk to me. Okay? I'm just saying. But the first to plead this case, it always seems right. How could there even be another side, right? Doesn't it seem, I mean, somebody, especially they're emotionally involved in this. Oh, I can't believe that person. Oh, I can't believe they did that. How could they have said such a thing? It always seems so right. But then you examine the other one. And then all of a sudden you realize how, that was a bit distorted. You got it? Enough said? We're all going to commit ourselves to this? Okay. All right. Okay, let's see. Now, what's this bit about the angels, the elect angels? I don't know, but there are a couple of possibilities. The word angel in Greek is angelos, thus the word angel, right? But in Hebrew, it's malak. And both have exactly the same meaning, which is a messenger. Nothing more, nothing less. Angelos and Malak both mean messenger. Now the question is this messenger a human being? Is this messenger an angelic creature, a supernatural creature? Is the messenger God himself? Is the messenger Yeshua? Is the messenger the Spirit? All of these are called angelos, or referred to in this way. All of them are. God, man, angelic creatures. If you've ever carried a message for someone to someone else, you've been an angel. That's what the word means. Just keep that in mind. It is not a religious word. We could put this in our list of more religious words that aren't religious that are used in the Bible. Remember, the Bible uses no religious terminology whatsoever. Angel, Malak means messenger. You must look at the context. Unfortunately, this verse, to me, doesn't give enough context. He says, in the presence of God and of Messiah Yeshua and the elect angels, I charge you to keep these rules without prejudging. Are these angelic creatures? Could very well be. Are they other messengers, pastors from other congregations, leaders, elders? Possibly. I think this is referring to angelic creatures, though. I do think it is referring to that here. because being a first century Jew, as all the Jews were of that time and even today, they have a very developed angelology, an understanding of angelic beings. And they see them as being very involved in human activity. And Hebrews also alludes to this, talking about how some have entertained angels, not aware of it. And I hear stories all the time. How many of them are actually true, I don't know. But the perception is somebody would show up on a scene, do something that was so timely and important and good, and then they look around, the person was gone. Yet they looked human, they felt human, they sounded human. Then the question was later, was it an angel or not? Was it an assistant, one of these who was sent to help us and aid us in our walk? I had one angelic encounter, but there was nothing to see. And many of you have heard this story, but when I was, maybe 19 years old, I had a motorcycle. And I was heading up the expressway, up State Route 8. And I got off, I think it was the Glenwood exit, wherever I was going, but I went, you know, the exit kind of goes uphill. And there was a traffic light up there, and there was a car stopped in front of me. And so I come up behind the car, stop the motorcycle, both feet flat on the pavement, waiting for the light to turn green and the car in front of me to go. I heard a bang behind me. I turned, and there was a Corvette whose brakes had gone out coming up the ramp. It hit the guardrail, bounced off, and it's coming straight at me. And it was closer than that music stand right there, which is maybe 12, 15 feet. It was right there. Now, it's coming. This is coming off the expressway. Its brakes were gone. I'm sitting on a motorcycle with both feet on the pavement. How do you get off a bike and get out of the way of a car that fast? You can't. But the next thing I knew, pop, it was on top of my motorcycle. I was sitting on the pavement, and the bumper of the car was an inch behind me. I could just lean back against the bumper. How does that happen? You can't jump when you got a motorcycle between your knees. It just doesn't work that way. So when the police showed up later, I'll never forget the guy's eyes when he came out of that Corvette. He thought there was going to be a bloody mess under his car. But the police came. In the meantime, I went and called a friend to get a ride. The police came, and he was looking under there, and I walked up, and I heard the police asking somebody else, well, did the ambulance already come and take him away? And I said, no, I'm right here. He's looking at me. You know, are you okay? Don't have a scratch. Don't have a bruise. That, to me, was a call. It was so clear to me. God says, you should be dead, but from this point on, you're mine. It was just as clear as if he'd written it in the sky. From this point on, you belong to me. And I made a commitment at that day. Okay, Lord, I belong to you because I should be dead. And the only explanation I have is that it was an angel. It was an angel. Nobody saw me get off the bike. There's no way in this world I could get off a bike that quick. But I was on it. Next thing, I'm just sitting on the ground, and my motorcycle stopped the car. That is just plain weird. Angelic encounter is the only thing only way I know of to explain that. And maybe you have had similar sorts of things. But the angels are very much involved in our lives, more than we imagine. And they've been sent as assistants and as messengers for us. Now, with that said, we are not to pray to angels. We're not to try to conjure up angels. We're not to try to communicate with angels. We can do that later when they get out the replays and show us all the things that they did to keep us alive up to this point. But right now, we don't do that. We don't engage them in that way. Okay? So, what are the angels here? You make up your mind. I kind of think it's referring to angelic creatures. And I think Paul is saying, I do this in the presence of God, King Yeshua, and the elect angels. Because when you don't keep these rules, when you're disrespecting elders, accusing them wrongly, making judgments when you don't have the facts, this is destructive behavior that will destroy any community. No community can survive spiritually or at least can remain healthy if this kind of stuff is happening. And Paul's saying, I call God, I call Yeshua, I call the ministering angels, these elect angels, to witness, because you're working against all of them. You're doing the work of the enemy, and you're actually fighting against the ones God has sent, these elect angels who he has sent to protect you, to take care of you, and help to channel you in the right direction. I call them as witnesses against you if you're behaving the way this describes. Makes sense? That's how I see it. But you, again, you make up your own mind. Maybe Paul's vague because he wants us to think of angels in both senses of the word. I don't know. And then in verse 22, he says, do not be hasty in the laying on of hands. This can refer to a couple of things. First of all, when a person became a believer, they went through about a one-year discipleship where they would prove themselves to be separate from the Greek culture of the day and the paganism and idolatry. They'd be learning the scriptures, learning how to operate in the community, studying the Didache, which we've talked about before, and to make sure that they're genuine. And then at the end of that year, or whatever term they decided to make it, they would then have the person fast. They would go through an immersion. They would make certain pronouncements of how they're going to live for Yeshua, for his kingdom from now on. And then when they were immersed, they would lay hands on them and bless them. We've done the same thing here at Beth Tikkun. It says, but don't do that suddenly. Let the person grow and mature, watch their lives, make sure this is genuine. The other thing you could be referring to is laying hands on someone to fulfill the position of an elder or a deacon or some other position in the congregation. Don't do that too early. We have a general policy here that when you come to Beth Tikkun, come and rest. We're not going to strap a job on you so that you can't get away. We're not going to do that. Just come and rest. Just learn who we are. Just take it easy and get to know us. Let's get to know you. So that after, for some things, 6 months, other things a year, then at that point, we'll know what your gifts are. We'll have a better idea who you are, if you're serious about your walk with God and you really want to be a part of this place. Then we may approach you and say, we have a job we think you'd be just right for. And we'll give them time to pray over it, discuss it with their spouse, and make a decision. And then if it's a position that is suitable for the laying on of hands, then we'll do that. So laying on of hands is a literal thing, but also I think it means investing authority. Don't be quick to do that. Get to know whoever it is under your authority if they're the right fit. And then, and only then, begin to acknowledge them in that position. And then verse 23 has nothing to do with anything Paul's been talking about, so you should put parentheses around it if they're not there already. No longer drink only water, but use a little wine for the sake of your stomach and your frequent ailments. The only reason I can imagine Paul putting this here is because Timothy was getting ulcers trying to run his community. That's the only thing I can figure. It's because why else would it pop it? Oh, by the way, Timothy, drink some wine. And I think maybe anybody in this position maybe needs a little wine. And you might get some stress and some stomach ulcers. So maybe that's why Paul pops it in. I don't know. But it seems like a very odd verse just to pop in there. And then he goes back to business. He says in verse 24, he says, the sins of some men are quite evident, going before them to judgment. For others, their sins follow after. Likewise, also, deeds that are good are quite evident, and those which are otherwise cannot be concealed. You can put it this way. Sin and good deeds have one thing in common. Whether they're obvious or hidden, they all come out in the open eventually. I know people who have hidden sins. I guarantee you those sins are going to become obvious and open in due time. And some people love to do good deeds, but do it anonymously, do them secretly, not to draw any attention to themselves. I want to tell you that eventually every good deed you've done is going to be rewarded openly. None of these things, bad or good, are kept secret forever. Okay? It all comes out. You know, sometimes I think teenagers, they live their life as if the whole world's watching them and there's a soundtrack playing in the background and they, you know, and they're like their life's a movie, which is really a lot of nonsense. Nobody's watching you. Nobody really cares how you dress or what fashions you use or how cool you are. But on the other hand, every one of us is making our own movie. And in eternity, since we'll have the time, every human being on earth will watch the full-length feature of every other human being on earth. I really believe that. So let's say the average age of all the human beings who have ever lived or ever will live is, let's say, 75 years. Multiply 75 years by every human being who's ever lived. And because you'll have new bodies, you're not going to get bored, you're not going to get tired, but you're going to be fascinated by every moment in every person's life, including yours. And it gets played back. And I think the most wonderful thing about this is we will see how every life that's ever lived, every life that's alive now, we'll see how every one of them interconnects with every other one. That they're all woven together. And everything person A does, it impacts person B and C and D. Good or bad, your lives impact all the other lives. Now, one of the things I constantly have to remind people of, so just to save my breath, I'm going to tell you all at one time. Some of you think, you know, when you don't come to Beth Dakoon, you think, well, you know, I didn't have anything to do that morning, and I just felt like staying at home, and I had a great time, quiet time with the Lord. It's all, okay, great, I get that. Sounds wonderful. But what these people don't realize, they really don't realize it, is the impact they have just by being here. By looking out and seeing your face. And other people, just by seeing your face and seeing your presence, there's an uplifting of the entire community by that person. And if in your mind you're thinking, well, that's not me, it is you. Your presence, just being here. You bring a spirit with you that you are completely oblivious to, but others are not. Your presence feeds people. It strengthens them. It encourages them. Whether you say a word or do nothing, your presence impacts other people. Don't you ever doubt that for a second. Now, there are a few people. You know, you've heard that some people are a blessing wherever they go and others are a blessing whenever they go. There are those. But I don't see any of those here. And so don't ever doubt that. Don't ever doubt that. And I know very particularly, sometimes I'll sit up here and I'll just think, okay, am I really ready to do this? And I'll see one face. I'll see one person. And it's like, oh, they're here. And it's like all of a sudden, boop. The light goes up. The energy level goes up a bit. I can't describe it. It's spiritual. It's spiritual. It's not a physical thing. But you do bring a spirit with you, a good, wholesome, beautiful spirit. And when you're not here, the entire body is weakened just a little bit. When you are here, the wattage goes up that much. Don't ever doubt the impact you have on the people here just by being present, just by being here. Okay, this is what we're going to do. Just so I feel better about myself, we're going to do the first couple of verses of chapter 6, okay? It says, because it is continuing like with the running of the congregation, it says, let all who are under a yoke as bondservants regard their own masters as worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and the teaching may not be reviled. Now this next verse, verse 2, I think is especially appropriate because I see this violated so often in the Redeemed community. It says, those who have believing bosses. I'm going to put the word boss there. You work for a boss who's a believer? If you have a believing boss, you must not be disrespectful on the ground that they are brothers. Rather, they must serve all the better. since those who benefit by their good service are believers and beloved. I've seen too many times, and I've had the same urge in my life, and I know I fall into it, is, you know, you're working for somebody, he's not a believer, so what do? You put on your best effort because you want to win them for Christ. And that's good. You want to be a good example to this person who doesn't know the Lord. But then you get a believer, he's a great guy, you talk about the sermons on Sunday and everything else, you think, I can slack off, he's just a brother, he's just a good old guy. And you begin to take advantage. That's wrong. That's really wrong. Here's what you can do. This is what I'm going to try to do. I've been practicing it. You can help me. And that's this. You know, when a new person comes to Beth Tacoum, people are, hi, how are you? You know, shaking their hand. Good to see you here. And here's a siddur, and, you know, and come eat food with us. So, you know, you're warm and everything. And it's perfect. Great. Don't change that. But after the person's been coming for a few months or years or whatever, yeah, you just got to treat them like, oh, it's good to see you. Come on in. How's the family? May I suggest that without being silly and goofy or extreme, that when you greet a brother, a sister, somebody who comes regularly, continue to a degree to treat them like it's their first time. And here's why. Because that person who came in the door today, if you walk with the Lord, you're not the same person you were a month ago. And certainly not the same person you were when we first met you. Because we're all growing. We're all changing. We're being renewed over and over again. So don't assume you already know the person because you already know the person. But take a renewed interest in one another. And you might begin to see, and not just see, but to help encourage that person to continue to grow. So to a certain degree, without being phony about it, greet one another as if it's the first time. Look in their eyes again and tell yourself again, I really want to get to know you. Not the you were 6 months or a year ago, but who are you now? Because we're all changing. Those little children under the hoopah, they're not going to be like that another 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. We don't know what they're going to become. But they're not going to be the same as what they were down here. And if you're really walking with the Lord, you're changing too. So take a renewed interest in each other. Get to know each other all over again. It's worth it. It really is worth it. So anyways, we're going to call it quits right there. Is that good enough? We'll do part two of 1 Timothy 5 and 6 next week. Are there any comments or questions that we need to address before we close in prayer? I see Brian's hand up back there. Mr. Kima, yes, sir.
Thanks, Grant. Welcome back.
Thank you.
This question stems from a friend who's getting ready to go on a missions trip, and it seems like every potential bad thing that could go wrong in advance before leaving is happening. So you often talk about how we often give Satan too much credit. How do we discern between, like, spiritual warfare and the evil one trying to stop us from doing something good versus, you know, maybe it's an angel or messenger trying to warn us or stop us from something? These are my friends Nick and Delana. We're in a Bible study together.
Oh, is this the couple you're talking about?
Yeah. No.
Oh, okay. I need to change my answer then.
But it's, we're studying together. Yeah, it's them. The joke's up. no, but like in the we're studying the book of Acts, and in Acts there's like a part, it was just a couple weeks ago, forget what chapter, but Paul is like directed via the Holy Spirit not to go to a certain destination. Yeah. How do we discern this?
Well, first of all, what are your names again?
Nick and Delana.
Nick and Delana, welcome. It's good to have you here.
It's actually not them going on the missions trip, I'm sorry. Oh. But they're just my friends that were in a Bible study. So it's, yeah, I don't know why I brought them up. I just want you all to be nice to them.
I was thinking so highly of you. No, just, okay. Well, then, Brian, Nick, and Delana, what you need to do is, I think, first of all, tell your friend that that's a decision that only they can make. We can speak into it, but only they can make that decision as to where, as to whether this is something God is doing to say, don't go, or it's the enemy saying, don't go. But the first question I would ask them is, whose authority are you under? Is it godly authority? Is it truly godly scriptural authority? And are they sending you? And if they're not being sent by a godly authority, they're just doing this on their own, I'd say, put the brakes on, back it up. Because there's a godly calling on a life, but there also has to be a godly sending. You'll always see both in the scriptures. And too many people get the first, but they don't get the second, and it's a disaster. So that's the first question I would ask. If they do have a godly sending on their lives, then they know who's the enemy in this case, or who's holding them up. And also, they may need to revisit, how do they know that they know that they know this is something they're supposed to do? And if it's been very clear this is something they're supposed to do, then it's just a test. Laugh at it and go on through. Just laugh at it. But if they don't have those two things, a godly sending and a very clear message that this is something they're to do, because this is a big thing. Mission trips should never be a hobby. And I'm not a big one on sending kids out on mission trips. I'm just not. It's just a vacation without the swimming pool, basically. And I'm just not into it. I don't think that's really conducive. I think we should take all the money for sending these kids and send it where it's needed. That'd be better. But that's, I'm sorry to get all opinionated, but jet lag is wearing down my reservations about saying things. But those are the two things I would take to Nicodelena. Yeah. I hope that's helpful. I don't know what they had to do with 1 Timothy 5 and 6, but we'll let it slide this time, Brian. Well, that's okay. I know, 1 Timothy. I know. That was jet lag. All right. I better close in prayer while I'm still conscious enough to do it. All right, thank you all for being so patient. Our Father and King, thank you so much for the holy words that you've given us through Paul as he wrote to his young charge, Timothy. And Father, I pray we take these words to heart because they are words of wisdom. They're sound words. And I pray that we would use them and others that are leading congregations and studies would use these words to do things the right way, to follow the rules for a healthy fellowship. And Lord, I pray you continue to bless Beth Dacoon, that we would be a place of restoration and repair. And I lift up Nick and Delaney and pray, Lord, you'd give them clear guidance. Protect them, Father, and prevent them from going if it's not your will for them to do so. Or if it's not your will for them to do so right now. But Father, if it's just the enemy, then Lord, I pray that you just give them open and obvious victory and let them see how every problem turns out to be an actual solution that will be a great blessing to them as they go. So Lord, I ask your blessing again upon us, that you'd make us the people you want us to be. And we thank you again for this time together in Yeshua's name. Amen. Well, let's stand together and